What will they say of us, those as yet unborn? What will be the verdict 100 years from now? Those who make the news and those who merely read it, will they say,
"We owe a great debt of gratitude to those who lived in the 1950s.
Or will there be no comment because there's no one around to make one? We have, it seems, a great responsibility.
The American Broadcasting Company and United Nations Radio present, transcribed, Evidence for a Verdict, narrated by Alastair Cook, an account of the cooperative international response to the challenge of the atom. And now to introduce the program, here is your host, John Daly.
In music, the overture is the aperitif, the appetizer, the herald of the opera or musical play to come. In life today, the scientific, technical, and political developments that crowd in upon us are the heralds of tomorrow. We are, in a sense, living through the overture to the grandest opera of all time. The scientist looks ahead. He sees a world in which 10,000 million people can enjoy all the necessities of life, necessities which, in too many parts of the world today, are luxuries. He sees the food, the clothes, the houses of tomorrow, produced in unlimited abundance through mastery of the atom, the air, the sea, the rocks, and the sunlight. He knows that these things can be, if there is peace. The statesman, too, looks ahead. He sees the same promise, the same prospect, the same dreadful hazard. He knows that to technical skill must be added wisdom, political wisdom. All our tomorrows will test the partnership of science and statesmanship, which this age has forged. And the future must be an acid test of international cooperation.
Have you ever seen the sun rise over a desert? It is one of the loveliest sights in nature, and if you've never had the opportunity to enjoy it, may we offer you the experience now. But the dawn we've chosen is a rather special one. The time is a few seconds before 5:30 a.m. The desert is in the state of New Mexico, USA. That range of mountains on the horizon is the Sangre de Cristos, the Blood of Christ range. And the date is July the 16th, 1945.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Thus, in the desert that morning, science tabled the first piece of crucial evidence. Exhibit A, the bomb. The atomic age had begun, though the world didn't know it then. The source of all power had been put in harness, though the shutters of wartime secrecy were firmly drawn. But not for long. Exactly 3 weeks later, on August the 6th, Exhibit A destroyed the city of Hiroshima. The big fact was out, and the effect was to shock and wound the minds of men. Here was something bigger than anything the minds of men had grappled with before. To comprehend, to digest what had happened, was not easy. In the months after Hiroshima, voices were raised in parliaments and newspapers, and in a million unrecorded discussions in a million private homes. There was fear among small, anonymous men, and there was fear among the great and respected.
"Since I do not see that atomic energy is to be a great boon for a long time, I have to say that for the present it is a menace."
So wrote Albert Einstein in November 1945. Fear was abroad in those months during which we lived in the shadow of the tower of vapor that looked like a mushroom. But mixed with it was a growing awareness of the change that Exhibit A had wrought and of the path which must be followed.
Every succeeding scientific discovery makes greater nonsense of old-time conceptions of sovereignty.
Those were the words of Sir Anthony Eden in the British House of Commons in November 1945.
The hope of civilization lies in international arrangements looking to the renunciation of the use and development of the atomic bomb and directing the use of atomic energy toward peaceful and humanitarian ends.
So wrote President Truman in a message to the United States Congress in October 1945.
If the basic problem of nuclear physics is not made a matter for international cooperation, the investigation of these natural phenomena will undoubtedly be delayed.
And so wrote the Russian scientist Professor Kapitsa in July 1946. But there's one date we haven't mentioned yet, October 24th, 1945. This was the day on which the United Nations began to put its charter to work, the charter proclaiming the world's determination to make an end of war and to promote progress and better standards of life. The atomic age and the United Nations were born together. The atom with its alternatives, precise and clear, the charter giving the world its opportunity to make the only possible choice. It was a most significant relationship, and its significance was recognized at once. One of the earliest decisions of the UN General Assembly was to set up the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission. On June the 13th, 1946, the commission held its first meeting. Among the speakers was Mr. Bernard Baruch of the United States.
My fellow members of the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission and my fellow citizens of the world, we cannot escape history. Behind the black portent of the new atomic age lies a hope which, seized upon with faith, can work our salvation. If we fail, then we have damned every man to be the slave of fear. Let us not deceive ourselves. We must elect world peace or world destruction.
The alternatives, precise and clear. The UN Atomic Energy Commission was given a brief containing three major items.
To encourage the exchange of basic scientific information among nations.
To work for the control and peaceful use of atomic energy.
To work towards the elimination of weapons of mass destruction.
The commission was able to record unanimous agreement on these desirable ends, but on the means to reach them, it was different. Although the world was frightened of the new elemental force and increasingly aware of its potential benefits, it was a world divided by suspicion. It was a world balanced uneasily in the clammy fingers of the Cold War. The result was that the nations with atomic knowledge went their separate ways, and those without it could do little but stand in the wings and watch in apprehension. The ramparts of secrecy were built a little higher. The hope for cooperation seemed, for a while, faint and forlorn. But it takes more than fear and suspicion to destroy an idea once it has taken root. Even in the bleakest hours, the voices were still raised. And in 1950, one of the greatest physicists of our age, Professor Niels Bohr of Denmark, wrote an open letter to the United Nations.
I turn to the United Nations in the hope that they may contribute to the search for a realistic approach to the grave and urgent problems confronting humanity. Every initiative from any side towards the removal of obstacles for free mutual intercourse and information would be of the greatest importance in breaking the present deadlock. The efforts of all supporters of international cooperation will be needed to create an opinion to voice with ever-increasing clarity and strength the demand for an open world.
The anxiety of the scientist in his study, knowing, perhaps more certainly than anyone, the issues involved, and the anxiety of the statesman in the conference room, knowing the delicate political issues now linked inseparably with the new discoveries of science. Here we recall from those uneasy days the voices of two men, leaders of their country's delegations to the United Nations. First, Mr. Lester B. Pearson of Canada.
It will be small comfort if and when some atomic bomb drops on us to know that while we have lost everything else, we have saved our sovereignty to the very end.
And General Carlos Romulo of the Philippines.
The choice is rapidly becoming either peaceful negotiation through the United Nations or the unimaginably horrible negotiation of mass murder on the battlegrounds of an atomic war.
Sooner or later, the climate had to change. Sooner or later, the initiative called for by Professor Bohr and desired by the whole world had to come. It came on December the 8th, 1953, in the General Assembly Hall at United Nations headquarters. President Eisenhower spoke to the assembled delegates of 60 nations, and he said,
"To hasten the day when fear of the atom will begin to disappear from the minds of people and the governments of the East and West, there are certain steps that can be taken now. I therefore make the following proposals. The governments principally involved, to the extent permitted by elementary prudence, to begin now and continue to make joint contributions from their stockpiles of normal uranium and fissionable materials to an international atomic energy agency. We would expect that such an agency would be set up under the aegis of the United Nations."
A bold and imaginative proposal. It seemed to brace the world's will for atomic cooperation and to stimulate the international efforts to achieve it. Everyone knew that the job ahead, the job of turning a suggestion into a working reality, would be long and intricate, and a great many difficult questions and problems had to be answered and solved. The discussions began.
First of all, what are the precise functions of this agency going to be? I mean, do you see it as a sort of atomic bank supplying fissionable material and technical service?
What about membership? Is everyone going to be eligible?
How about status? Is every member going to be equal, or are those with the know-how going to get preferential treatment?
And another thing. If the agency is going to provide fissionable material from its stocks, how is it going to make sure that the stuff is used for peaceful purposes? After all, this is the stuff that bombs are made of.
Have any of you considered how the agency should be organized? By the same token, what about its relationship to the UN? Is it going to be like the other specialized agencies, or is it going to be different?
These were some of the matters with which the negotiations were concerned as the months went by. But the changing climate was weakening those barriers of secrecy, those blocked channels of scientific communication that had been so formidable 3 years ago. Behind them, on March the 1st, 1954, the atomic transition from A to H was accomplished. Exhibit B was exploded at Bikini, adding, if any addition was necessary, a new element of urgency. And behind them, two impressive developments in the peaceful use of the new force continued. Experimental power stations, the production and application of isotopes in medicine, industry, and agriculture. But there was little or no sharing of this mounting volume of knowledge, and without it, the full tempo of progress could not be realized. It was as if the whole world was a train being driven with the brakes on. The power was there, but from the fear of it, nobody would release the brakes. Until the end of 1954.
The General Assembly, 9th Session, Resolution A/230.
The General Assembly, believing that the benefits arising from the momentous discovery of atomic energy should be placed at the service of mankind, decides that an international technical conference should be held to explore the means of developing the peaceful uses of atomic energy through international cooperation, and suggest that the conference should be held no later than August 1955 at a place to be determined.
This was Geneva, the Palace of Nations, to which in August last year more than 1,400 scientists and engineers came from 72 countries. As the weeks of preparation for the great meeting passed and the learned papers were submitted, the conviction grew that this was going to be an historic occasion. At the beginning of the conference, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, said,
"When, in the history of mankind, have men of knowledge, representing so many diverse and distant nations, congregated to offer the best of their minds and goodwill in order to promote knowledge and, through knowledge, peace?"
At the end of the conference, the Indian scientist Dr. Homi Bhabha, who had been its president, said this:
"Knowledge once given cannot be taken back. And in organizing this conference, the nations of the world have taken an irreversible step forward, a step from which there is no retreat."
There is no doubt that the Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy was a step forward, an immense step. The talk was frank, and it was objective. It released again the free flow of ideas and information that had been clogged for so many years by suspicion and distrust. It revealed, too, many new problems which the peaceful use of the atom was creating, problems calling for cooperation in a number of different but closely related fields. On the agenda at Geneva were items such as these:
the role of nuclear energy in the production of power, the building of a nuclear energy enterprise.
Class these among the industrial applications. Set them against the expanding demand for power in all countries, especially those now engaged on great programs of economic development. And for a report, call on the UN's Economic and Social Council.
We have initiated a worldwide study of the possible applications of atomic energy in industry and agriculture. Under the Council, the Economic Commissions for Europe, Asia, and the Far East and Latin America are actively collecting and circulating information on the needs of their regions and planning the introduction of atomic energy in them within the next 20 years.
Turn now to another section of the Geneva Agenda.
Item: biological effects of radiation. Item: reactor safety and location of power reactors. Disposal of radioactive waste.
Health and safety. For international cooperation in these fields, call on the World Health Organization and the International Labor Organization.
We're working on the problems of waste disposal from atomic plants and on health considerations in the siting of reactors. We're seeking uniform, worldwide standards of measurement of the amount of radiation dangerous to man, as well as codes of practice in the medical applications of radiation.
And the International Labor Organization, ILO.
Now that industry is beginning to use radioactive materials more and more, the protection of workers against radiation hazards is a vital matter. Health and safety standards for the industrial use of the atom have already been worked out.
At Geneva, there were many highly technical discussions.
Reactor session. Item: the technical principles of fast neutron reactors and thermal neutron reactors.
Call for a report from the UN agency concerned with the promotion of basic scientific research, the Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO.
In basic research, we may note the organization's initiative in the establishment of the European Center for Nuclear Research, the internationally supported laboratory near Geneva. To help meet the growing need for trained research workers and technicians, we may note the granting of study fellowships and the promotion of regional training programs.
Consider next the item at Geneva designated Session 13C.
Radioactive isotopes and ionizing radiations in agriculture.
Here, the link is through the Food and Agriculture Organization.
FAO is acting as a clearinghouse for the collection, analysis, and interpretation of information on all aspects of the atom and agriculture. In Europe already, and shortly in Central America, it is promoting a program of cooperative research on the uses of radiation in the improvement of crops and the study of plant genetics.
Other agencies contribute in other fields. The World Meteorological Organization has studied the possible effects of bomb test radiation on the weather and found no significant relationship. The International Civil Aviation Organization is seeking international agreement on the classifications, labeling, and packaging of radioactive materials such as isotopes for safe transportation, And there is another body in which the nations are combining their efforts to solve a problem of paramount importance. This is the 15-nation committee established last year by the UN General Assembly to study the effects of atomic radiation. The reason for setting up this committee is this. Though adequate safety measures are already enforced to protect man from direct injury by exposure to radiation, we are still faced with a big question mark over the long-range genetic effects. We still don't know enough about possible damage to future generations from very slight exposure to natural and artificial radiation now. A number of studies of this problem are being made in different countries, and this international committee is extending the work to global dimensions. Let one of its experts explain the task in hand.
Well, our main job is to determine just how harmful man-made radiation is. We need a lot of information from every part of the world. We've asked members of the UN and the specialized agencies to send us measurements of natural radioactivity in their different regions, measurements of fallout from weapons tests, and measurements of pollution, if any, caused by existing atomic plants. We're also concerned with the effects of radiation used for medical purposes, like diagnostic X-rays. By 1958, we hope to be able to present a comprehensive report and recommendations for any action that may be necessary to the General Assembly.
So the fabric of cooperation acquires strength and a clearly recognizable design. But what of the greatest single element in that design? What of the proposed agency? How have the negotiations progressed since President Eisenhower made the first proposal in December 1953? The answer is steadily and well, so well that we may expect the new agency to be in operation next year. By April the 18th this year, a draft statute for the agency had been written. It is now being studied by 87 member nations of the United Nations and its specialized agencies. In September, delegates will assemble at the UN headquarters for a conference to work out the final form. The draft will become the statute. And after that, when not less than 18 nations have approved the document, the International Atomic Energy Agency will be in business. But without waiting for that day, we can already answer these questions.
What will be the precise functions of the agency?
Consult the draft statute and you'll find this.
The agency will encourage research and the practical applications of atomic energy throughout the world. To this end, it will be authorized to provide materials, services, and equipment. And if necessary, it will be able to acquire or build atomic plants. The particular needs of the economically underdeveloped parts of the world are noted specifically. It will help in the exchange of information and scientific experts, and it will coordinate and apply health and safety standards in areas near any project it may aid.
What about membership?
And the status of members?
And how is it going to be organized?
On these points, the draft statute has this to say.
Membership is open to any country who's a member of the UN or any of the specialized agencies. Other countries can also join if the agency's Board of Governors recommends them and the General Conference of the agency agrees.
And as for status?
The fact that atomic power is of special interest to the underdeveloped countries doesn't mean that the agency will be a sort of charitable organization, supplying skill and material from the resources of the advanced countries for the benefit of the less advanced. Throughout all the negotiations, the principle of equality has been recognized.
Finally, there is the important question of safeguards.
To make sure that none of the material it supplies is used for military purposes, the agency will require all establishments receiving its help to keep detailed records of how the material is being used. It will also have its own qualified inspectors who, to quote the actual words of the draft statute, will have access at all times to all places, persons, and data necessary to determine whether there is compliance with the undertaking against the use of materials for any military purpose.
And if it's found that they are being used for military purposes?
The agency can then stop its help and withdraw any material or equipment that has been made available.
And if the recipient refuses to give up the material?
The statute requires a full report to the Security Council of the United Nations, which, as you know, is the body charged with the maintenance of international peace.
That, then, is the way it looks now. When the 18 ratifications of the final wording of the statute have been received, and the agency is a going concern, its relationship to the United Nations will be established by mutual agreement. These, however, are administrative details. Without waiting for their final settlement at the September conference, it is not going too far to say that in combining their efforts to establish the agency, the nations of the world have taken another irreversible step forward, a step which will accelerate and enlarge the contribution of atomic energy to the peace, health, and prosperity of the world. You have heard the evidence. Evidence that emerged first from a shadow of fear.
Let us not deceive ourselves. We must elect world peace or world destruction.
You have heard evidence of how the scientists and statesmen made the only possible choice.
I therefore make the following proposals. The governments principally involved to begin now and continue to make joint contributions from their stockpiles.
You have heard evidence of how both the spirit and machinery of cooperation has developed through agencies already in existence, and how it should reach a full flowering in the coming International Atomic Energy Agency. Seldom, we believe, has a more convincing case been prepared. Never before has the world laid such firm and far-sighted foundations to meet the challenge of a great new technological revolution. And the verdict? The verdict of those as yet unborn? Unless we falter, unless some incredible madness should possess us, surely in 100 years from now, they will be able to say,
we owe a debt of gratitude to those who lived in the middle of the 20th century. You have been listening to Evidence for a Verdict, an account of the international response to the challenge of the atom. The narrator was Alastair Cook. This program is produced and transcribed by the American Broadcasting Company and the international staff of United Nations Radio.